So now we're being recorded. It's our pleasure to have here Matt. He's a grad student at Princeton. He will tell us about stochasticity and axon direct detection. Thanks, Matt, for joining us today.
All right. Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. It's great to be here virtually. But I just want to preface everything I'm about to say with, please interrupt me if you have questions. I also tend to get overexcited and talk really fast. So I also can't see the chat. So if there are chat messages pertaining to me, read them, just interrupt me, please. My name is Matt. I'm a grad student at Princeton. And this is some work that I've been working on over the last few months. Hopefully we'll be out within the next month or two with Mariangela Lasanti and Will Toronto. Okay, so I'll just give you an overview of what everything that's gonna go on. I'll just give a kind of broad introduction to dark matter, ultralight, axion-like particles. I'm gonna refer to everything as an axion, even though really pretty much everything I'm talking about is more generally applicable to any sort of ultralight scale or dark matter. But then I'll motivate some specific types of direct detection experiments just to get a sense for sort of like what the observable things are. And then I'll provide you just a sketch of, how stochasticity enters into the, into the equation and why it matters. Then I'll present the main talk is sort of in two parts. One is about the full construction for, the experiments that are sensitive directly to the axion field. And then I'll talk about I'll show you the calculation and the limits. And then also the second part, a separate treatment for experiments that are sensitive to the field gradient. Okay. So I will begin with the introduction. So we know dark matter exists. This is a very pretty plot of the bullet cluster, two colliding galaxy clusters, they collided with each other. We know that most of the matter is in X-rays, where most of the visible matter is from X-rays. The dark matter halos pass through each other and are visible through lensing. We know that we know from the cosmology, roughly 85% of the universe is 85% of the matter of the universe is dark matter. We know galactic rotation curves are flat. There's some hit, there is dark matter in our galaxy. It's roughly virialized. And so that means it moves non-relativistically today. We also have measured the local dark matter density through astrophysical means. It's about 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. Other than that, there's not really much we know definitively about dark matter. In this talk, I'm going to be mostly talking about things that are quote unquote ultra light. And it's important to note that for fermions, as the local density is fixed and you can only pack so many fermion particles into a particular volume. And so the observation of small structure of dark matter limits the mass of any fermionic dark matter candidate to be about 100 eV, or at least the limit is at least as strong as about 100 eV. And of course, for scalars, that's not the case. And scalars can be essentially, you can pack as many scalars in as you want, but eventually the de Broglie wavelength of the scalar becomes larger than the size of the dark matter substructure that we have observed. And that occurs somewhere in this sort of 10 to the minus 22, 10 to the minus 20 EV. And the things I'm going to talk about are basically between these two mass ranges, are relevant between these two mass ranges. So between about 10 to the minus 20 EV and about 1 EV. Okay, so in terms of if dark matter is a particle, or even if it's not a particle, how do you explain the existence of dark matter? There's a whole zoo of possible models, from supersymmetry, extra dimensions. You can have primordial black holes. You could have modified gravity type scenarios. As I mentioned, I'm going to be focusing on light scalars, and pretty much everything I'm going to be talking about is sort of general, applicable to everything in this broad category of light spin zero particles. But I'm going to always say and refer in concrete ways to axion-like particles or axions. Okay, so, you know, if I'm talking about ultralight axion dark matter, as I mentioned, the local energy density for dark matter is what it is. It's fixed. And so as you turn the mass down, the number of particles you have in any particular volume increases. In particular, the correct treatment for the axion particle dark matter is as a classical field when the occupancy number of each mode is large, which is turns out to be roughly whenever the mass is much less than an EV. That's what I was alluding to before. And so if this is the case, then roughly the axion field at any particular point in space will just oscillate in time with frequency set by its mass, and then amplitude set by the fact that the RMS value of this guy, of this oscillating thing, should be the local dark matter density times the mass squared, or times the mass, depending on where you put the square root in that. And so if you work that out correctly, you get this sort of this prefactor for the axion field. And the point here, just observationally, is that roughly speaking, the axion oscillates at the frequency set by its mass. So you basically, the frequency domain is very natural for, you know, these sort of observational things. You tend to be just looking for things that are oscillating at one particular frequency and spikes in frequency space. Of course, there are subtleties on that, but okay. So in terms of actual like concrete particle physics, as I mentioned, I'm going to be talking about axion-like particles, which I'll just call axions. These are sort of inspired by the QCD axion, which solves the strong CP problem, but it's basically just an effective field theory for a pseudoscalar. I didn't put anything in the slides about this, but it's sufficient to say that it is possible to cosmologically obtain the local dark matter, the observed dark matter density today with these types of particle physics models. So in terms of concrete couplings, I'll present to you two examples. There are others. The axion can couple to two photons. The pseudoscalar coupling goes like AFF dual, which is E dot B. For the ultralight dark matter case, in the axion dark matter background, which the axion just acts like a background scalar field, and this just leads to modifications to the classical E&M equations, Maxwell's equations. This is usually probed using just sort of classical E&M techniques, microwave cavities, et cetera. As another example, there is an axion coupling to two fermions, in particular fermions spins. It goes with the gamma 5 gamma mu operator. And in particular, for observational purposes, it's most concrete to talk about, it's sort of most relevant to talk about the spin of nucleons, which is why I wrote it as n's. But in the non-relativistic, this operator reduces to something like the gradient of the axion field dotted into the spin of the fermion. And so, again, for ultralight dark matter, this grad A just acts like a background field. And what it does is induces a quasi-magnetic field. It acts like a magnetic field. So the spins will tend to preferentially align with the gradient of the axion field. Because it deals with nucleons and spins, is sort of most usefully probed with NMR or AMO techniques. Again, with the concrete examples, I'll just present to you a particular experiment that searches for the axion photon coupling, which my favorite one, everyone has a favorite, I guess, is Abracadabra. The basic idea, as I mentioned, is that in the presence of the background axion dark matter field, Maxwell's equations are modified. In particular, they all get some modification, but the Ampere's law gets a modification where there's essentially a pseudo electric current, which is depends on the axion properties. In the case of Abracadabra, what they're doing is generating some large magnetic field B. Which then because the axion field is oscillating at frequency MA, dA dt is non-zero, is just generally non-zero. And so this will lead to an oscillating current in the direction of B. It's a pseudo current, but so it looks like there's an electric current with this, with this density. For Abracadabra, what they do is they generate the magnetic field in a torus. And so what that leads to is basically a loop, an effective loop of current that's going around, and it's an alternating current because of this cosine term. And then that alternating current source is an alternating B field through the, the center of the torus. And you can measure that pretty, very well with things like SQIDs and other, other comagnetometers. We were working in the frequency domain. The observable will generally be proportional to, dA dt, but dA dt is itself proportional to A of t. I guess the key point here is just that, this is one particular example, at the end of the day, you generally will get, with these types of experiments, either an observable that's proportional to grad A or A of t.
What do you call a pseudocurrent?
It's a pseudocurrent in the sense that there aren't actually electrons moving, right? It sources in this case, if you have a non-zero, it's a pseudocurrent in the sense that if it forms a loop, it sources a B field. So if this pseudocurrent forms a closed loop like it does in a toroidal geometry, it creates a real magnetic field, despite the fact that there are no actual electrons going through. Just to get a sense of sort of like what the space for the axion photon couplings look like, the Abracadabra lives here. So this is the axion mass. This is 1 eV, 10 to the minus 12. As I mentioned, it goes down another 10 orders of magnitude in terms of like what is kind of feasibly, theoretically conceivable as dark matter. Abracadabra lives somewhere around here. They could, they can in principle extend, of course, with a larger apparatus to lower couplings, but also to lower masses. Other experiments, ADMX, haystack, microwave cavities tend to live at microwave frequency ranges, which are around here. I would be remiss to mention light shining through walls there and lots of astrophysical bounds, which are relevant. Things like CAST, which are coming from axions produced in stars, not the dark matter halo directly, which is sort of the main, what I'm talking about. So that's just kind of the general landscape. The point is just that there are lots of, there are lots of experiments. They all will either be, the observable will be proportional to the axion field A of t or its gradient. Here's another example, this time talking about the axion nucleon coupling, is helium-potassium comagnetometers. So this is kind of flown under the radar for a lot of people, I think. So I'll take a little bit of time to explain it a bit more carefully. The basic idea is you pump up, you spin polarize two species, the valence electrons in a potassium atom and the nuclei of helium-3 atoms. The spin of the helium-3 nucleus is dominated by the neutron, it is what it is, I guess. And there's a hyperfine coupling between, the electron and the electron spin and the nucleus spin. And so, they both source these macroscopic magnetizations. When you put them together, interact with each other, they will tend to co-align with each other. And you can measure, just via like a circular polarized laser, you can measure the spin projection of the electrons onto some lab axis. Okay, now the key thing with the comagnetometer is that you additionally after you pump up these spins, and you sort of are continuously repumping the electrons, but you apply a large magnetic field over the entire thing and tune that magnetic field to a very particular region where the effective magnetic field sourced by the helium and felt by the potassium is exactly canceled by the lab magnetic field. And so what this means is that the electrons are essentially free, are now just free particles. It's a free spin. And so if a real magnetic field that is slowly varying enters into the equation and sort of shifts the net external magnetic field, the helium magnetization will co-rotate with that and continue to cancel out the magnetic field felt by the electrons. And so the electron spin doesn't move. However, if you have if you have an anomalous magnetic field that couples differently to electrons and neutrons, such as the case for an axion, which, you know, if this coupling is non-zero, and I'm neglecting the GA, there's also a GAEE coupling, which I'll just ignore. But if the coupling of the axion to the nucleon is non-zero, then there's an effective magnetic field that goes like grad A that's felt only by the helium nuclei, but not by the electrons. And so the helium will rotate, and that will throw everything out of equilibrium, and the potassium and the electron spin will have to compensate back. And so you would see in the presence of an axion field, you see the electron spins oscillate in a way that's proportional to this term, grad A dotted into whatever measurement axis you're projecting the spin along. And so again, this is a really precise and beautiful experimental technique and at the end of the day, it enables you to measure something that, you know, a signal that would go like the gradient of the field dotted into some lab fixed axis. So, and here's the parameter space for the axion nucleon coupling as a function of MA. These blue curves are different comagnetometers. And you can see they're extremely precise. They don't, according to this work, although, you know, this may be subject to recasting based on what I'm about to tell you later in the talk. These constraints don't quite get down below astrophysical constraints, but they're still many orders of magnitude above experiments like CASPER, which also probe the same couplings. And I guess the other thing to point out is just the range of frequencies here. So unlike abracadabra, which deal with electromagnetic signals, where we tend to measure things pretty well between 1 hertz and well above a hertz, like between a kilohertz or larger, for comagnetometers tend to be better at lower frequencies. And so that's why these tend to cover frequencies less than a kilohertz. And that corresponds, of course, to lighter masses. And as I'm about to show you, lighter masses means, in some sense, more, you care more about the stochastic effects of the axion field, which I'll talk about. Okay. So that enough introduction. If anyone has any questions about what I just said.
Sorry, I was trying to unmute myself.
Okay, yeah.
Can I ask you about low frequencies here? Besides what you're going to talk about, why, for example, does the line below 10 to minus 22 EV just go flat in the exclusion? It shouldn't.
I'm actually not sure on that. So I don't know. I have honestly kind of ignored everything. I've always just sort of ignored everything below 10 to the minus 22 EV. That's a good question. I think it shouldn't be.
Yeah, the other thing is because there's also the question about the duration of where they were taking measurements, right?
Yeah.
There should be, yeah.
Yeah, so they counted. So this work, this is from a paper by Tomer Volansky and others. They did account for these stochastic properties, but not in the full, not in the 100% correct way.
Yeah, but this is not about stochastic here. I mean, it's the fact that if you have an oscillatory signal, you could be sitting at the time where the signal is zero, right? Because you go through, it's oscillating, the magnetic field is oscillating. So you could be close to, artificially close to a zero of the field. So you're losing, so the analysis, this is just Fourier, you should be decoupling at low energies. Independent, even if it was purely monochromatic, the signal should be decoupling.
Yeah. Well, it just depends on, this is an interesting question, Mina. And I don't remember exactly how they recast these bounds. What it comes down to is how you account for the fact that, yeah, at very low frequencies, you're of course only sampling, you get one shot at, whatever the axion field is.
Yeah.
It's like, right here, the oscillation is like one per year, right? So you have to add, and probably I think what they did in some sense was averaging over that. And so there's a suppression associated with the effect, but it doesn't necessarily go to zero.
You should be decoupling. It should be decoupling linearly with the frequency. I mean, I guess inversely, I mean, it should go like, anyway, continue. I don't want to give
you,
it's not the main purpose of your talk.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question, but I guess my first guess as to answer your question is just that in the limit of very low frequencies, okay, I mean, yeah, I guess you're right. In the limit, as MA goes to zero, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's honestly not super well defined. But anyway, I'll proceed. But I'd be happy to talk about this later.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. So I'm gonna now just like briefly sketch and try to provide some intuition for the meat of what I want to talk about. So a little more carefully than what we did before, right? We know that the axion field will oscillate with frequency set by its energy, right? And the dark matter is non-relativistic, so this frequency is basically just ma plus 1/2 mv squared. And v is small, v squared is about 10 to the minus 6. So, you know, sort of to first order, you can always neglect that and treat it as frequency oscillations at frequency ma. But in reality, there's an additional small correction to that. And now the kicker comes from the fact that there's also a velocity dispersion, which comes from essentially astrophysics properties. The dark matter should be roughly virialized, and so its velocity distribution should be roughly Maxwell-Boltzmann with some velocity dispersion sigma. And so what this means is that when you kind of count the contribution from all the different V modes, each mode has a different frequency. And that frequency dispersion is, you know, goes like ma sigma squared. And so what this means is that if your field has evolved over a long time, over many coherence times, then what you get is a random amplitude every time the time evolves by order one over the frequency dispersion. Which we call that time scale of the coherence time, which I'll denote tau c, and it turns out to be roughly one day if the axiom if the mass is 10 to the minus 14 eV, and as ma decreases, this gets larger, right? So at 10 to the minus 16 eV, you're at about a year, and the key point here is that experiments that we run here on Earth have a finite time scale for observation, which is you know at most like 1 year or a few years, and so if the mass is much lighter than say 10 to the minus 16 eV, then you aren't sampling, you only get one random amplitude fluctuation. This is just illustrating the point I was saying. So if the coherence time is much larger than the time scale of your experiment, as a function of the time over your experiment, the amplitude of oscillations will be constant. Where if the coherence time is much larger, or sorry, much smaller than the observation time, at every time you sample, you get a random amplitude of oscillations, right? So that's what these blue triangles. You're just randomly sampling and sort of you're sampling the full distribution of the amplitudes. Where, of course, if the time scales are roughly equivalent to each other, you see sort of a smooth random walk process. I want to motivate for you what this distribution, what the probability distribution is of these amplitudes. So the way we're going to treat this is, after some long time, but considered on timescales less than the coherence time, each velocity mode essentially gets its own random frequency, which is set by however long, wherever this frequency has evolved to at that time. And that, sorry, I think I may have misspoke, but it gets a random phase. And the random phase will remain constant for roughly the coherence time scale. And so now we just do a little bit of math. The details are not super important, but this is now just a random walk in. If you think of this as an exponential, it's just a random, it's a random walk as you sum over these guys of fixed step length. Equivalently, you can trig decompose it and then use the central limit theorem. So let me take an aside and just point out the central limit theorem, which basically says that up to some normalization, whenever you sum over random variables, as long as the number of independently identically distributed random variables is large enough, you get a normally that sum is normally distributed, where the mean of that normal distribution is roughly, is proportional to the mean of each of these individual random variables, and the covariance is the covariance of the individual random variables. And so in the case of what I was just sketching, we're talking about a set of two independent sums or two separate sums of a cosine and sine where phi is a random phase. And cosine and sine are orthogonal to each other in some sense. And so what you get is that, and they average to zero. So the mean of this distribution is zero and the covariance is diagonal. And you get a 1/2 from the average value of cosine squared is 1/2. Okay, so putting this back, what this means is that the axion field, as I've decomposed it, the amplitude of the cosine mode and the amplitude of the sine mode should both be independently normally distributed with variance 1/2. So if you change variables and rescale this guy, what you get is you get this. So there's a 1/√2, but basically this alpha, the distribution of this alpha, which is square root of the sum of the squares of two Gaussian random variables, is the distribution of the amplitude for the axion field. And this distribution has a special name. It's called the Rayleigh distribution, or you can also think of it as the square root of the chi distribution with 2 degrees of freedom, the square root of the chi squared distribution with 2 degrees of freedom. But the Rayleigh distribution is, has this PDF, it's just x times e to the minus 1/2 x squared. And it looks like this, right? So the key point is that, if you naively were to, insert alpha, you're living at alpha equals square root 2, which is like here, right? The deterministic approach puts you here. The mean is here, but in reality, it's following some the amplitude is following some distribution, and if you happen to just randomly be at a point where you sampled your amplitude to be zero, your limit should get weaker in accordance with the probability of that occurring. So that's the basic idea. Just like a little more carefully, but still tilde level, right? Suppose we had some coupling. Suppose we do some experiment with some coupling G that's proportional to, this should be kind of tilde level true for both experiments that are proportional to the axion field or the field gradient. But very roughly, right, you could imagine the case of like, if I discover something, what is the actual, like, how do I set a confidence interval based on this random amplitude? Or if I don't discover something, how do I set a limit, right? And very roughly, right, the experiment should constrain the amplitude times the coupling to be constant. This is set by either the noise, if it's a null result, or it's set by whatever the observed amplitude of the signal you found is. So that means that the posterior distribution for the coupling should go like 1/alpha, where alpha is a Rayleigh distributed thing. And so that's this distribution that I plotted here. It's the same distribution in both cases. The dashed red line corresponds to alpha equal to its root mean square value. So that would be sort of where you, if you didn't account for this random amplitude at all, you would set your limit. I'll just talk about the case of the limit because I guess it's probably, until someone discovers something, we don't really need to worry about this. So if you don't account for this random amplitude at all, you would set your limit here at roughly your noise threshold, right? If you instead want to say like, okay, I want the 95% containment on the coupling, you're actually, some order, like slightly larger than order one factor above that threshold. And then of course, this is neglecting the fact that, noise is random. It's not just that you don't just set your limit equal to your noise threshold. You're basically additionally convolving this with a Gaussian distribution if your noise is Gaussian. So that will basically spread out. That will spread out this limit even further. But the basic idea is that in order to be such and such confident that you've not seen that your coupling is below your limit value, you have to go a little bit extra. You have to go a little bit higher, right? You have to be more conservative because of these random amplitude fluctuations.
Matthew, can I ask you something that I'm a bit confused about? So I understand all this argument that the phases are random, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now, your calculation assumes that you have over one coherence length of the axion, you have one phase, which is given by one velocity of that distribution that you're sampling on. Over the next coherence length, the phase, it's random, because your velocity distribution is random, so you have another phase, right? So the origin of the difference in phases is because you have a velocity distribution. Not all of the axions have the same velocity, right?
Yes, exactly.
Now, aren't like patches that are exactly next to each other? You are taking those patches to be absolutely uncorrelated, right?
Isn't
that a good assumption? Like, aren't patches that are absolutely next to each other, isn't there any sort of correlation between those patches? I will naively assume that there is some correlation because the way that you distributed these velocities, it happened because of the dynamical process. So these axions went into the galaxy, like they collapsed, mm-hmm. and by a dynamical process, they got different velocities in different patches, right? But I will assume that close by patches, they have correlated velocities.
No, that's certainly true. Although I believe this is a subtle point. I believe that as I'm secretly assuming not only that after a long time t greater than tau, but that this is actually much, much greater. In particular that, so every coherence time, you sort of, your slowest, the lowest frequency here will sort of move by one, some order one fraction of 0 to 2 pi. Right. And if you then, and then all the others sort of moved in accordance to that. But then if you then evolve over many, many coherence times, you're dispersing that one randomly. And then all the others are also dispersed randomly. And it depends, like there are correlations, but it depends very sensitively on exactly how many coherence times that's evolved. And I think for all, the number of time evolutions I'm talking about is sort of the age of the galaxy, which at least for the most of the things I have in mind, coherence times of like a day to a year, a day to a year or a few years, maybe tens of years, but not millions of years, which is when the axion field first started oscillating in the galaxy, I guess, is. Mm-hmm. Okay. But yeah, that was a really good question. So that was all just a sketch, right? I was being very tilde level. And so let me be a little bit more careful for the case specifically of the field itself, not worrying about gradients yet. Okay, so as I was saying, right, assuming that the field has been oscillating for a long time, you can start each mode at some random phase. This is the axion field of just a single mode with a single velocity. Its RMS amplitude should give the dark matter density divided by the total number of modes. But otherwise this is basically the same as what we saw before. And so now let me kind of take the intermediate.
Matt, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
So are you weighting each mode by the same coefficient?
In here? Yeah. Yes, because what I'm saying is that the energy, this amplitude should be like the root mean square energy density. And V is still small. So the energy of each mode is contribution is basically the same of MA. So so this amplitude should, strictly speaking, get a slightly different weight depending on what the velocity is, but that's a very small effect and it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
The reason
so
that
the V's are always small compared to like the escape velocity, you're saying?
So it's not the escape velocity, it's the MA. So So what I'm saying is that V is always, it's a subtle point and I haven't quite thought of how to explain it very clearly.
Well, so naively, right? So I would have thought that you would have, weighted the modes according to like the distribution function.
You mean the out with the rail? So I'm getting there. That comes here. Right. I guess the thing I just wanted to say is right. The V squared is all like this term is always much smaller than this term, but it matters when it's inside. But this term can still matter when it's inside an oscillating thing, because then you only care about what this is mod 2 pi, right? Whereas if we're talking about putting an MA plus 1/2 MV squared over here, somewhere in the amplitude where you don't care about mod 2 pi, you can always ignore the V squared part. And I'm getting to the velocity distribution part. So this is just for a single velocity. And so now let me additionally take the intermediate step. Of course, what we want to do is just sum over all velocities. But let me take the intermediate step to consider a chunk of velocity space that is between V and V plus delta V. And, there are some number of modes that lie in this chunk. And I'm going to sum over them and superimpose these things. And so now I factored out as 1 over root n here. So there's a root n j over n here, which I've replaced with the velocity distribution. And then again, this sum extends over all axion, over all modes that have essentially velocity close enough to Vj. And each one has a different random phase. So the only thing that depends on the summation index I here is this phase. So now we can take this contribution and evaluate the sum in using the central limit theorem exactly the way we did before. What you get is you trade the large number of random phases for a single random amplitude and a single random phase. And now the full field is just summing over all chunks of phase space, right? So I sum this over J. And I've here, going from here to here, I've additionally taken delta V to be the escape, you know, V lives on zero to V escape. And so I've taken delta V to be V escape over the number of chunks that I've subdivided into. This can still be a very large number. Okay, and we're summing over J here. Additionally, I want to consider the full time behavior of this thing. So I want to consider on some finite, on some discrete time series, say M, I'll call it M values of T. I want to consider this random thing. And so the way to treat this, it's useful to decompose into cosine MAT and sine MAT modes, although you don't have to. But it, I find it useful to do that. And then we want to evaluate these A and B coefficients over, so there are two coefficients times M, each one evaluated at M different times. We have two M different summations, right? I have one summation for every time and for every A and B. And, but basically the plan is to just use the central limit theorem again. I can additionally take V to be a, you know, V I'm initially imagining to be a like kind of a discrete grid, but it's the same as taking V to be a uniform random variable. And that makes it just all that makes the presentation of the central limit theorem all the more manifest. Okay, so in case you forgot, here's the central limit theorem again. If you have the sum of, so here each, you have a sum of N independent identically distributed random variables. Each random variable is a k-dimensional thing. In the case of the previous, right, so I just went back a slide, k is 2m here, right? So I have 2m different independent summations, I always use the word independent, but 2m simultaneous summations, which are not independent of each other necessarily, right? It depends on whether the mean is the mean of each individual random variable, and the covariance is the covariance of these random variables. At the end of the day, this sum is still guaranteed to be normally distributed as long as n is large by the central limit theorem. Okay, so this is just what I was saying. And at the end of the day, what you get is that this 2m component sum is normally distributed. The mean is zero, and this follows from the fact that sines and cosines average to zero. And the covariance is non-zero. In particular, it has this block diagonal structure where the on diagonal elements are equal to the integral over the velocity distribution times cosine 1/2 mv squared tm minus tn, right? So it depends on the difference in time. There's a symmetry along the diagonal for these guys, and similar for these, except you just switch the sine to cosine mode. And these are, so this is saying like how, so this is saying how A, the A mode, the cosine mode, is correlate at time tm is correlated with time tn. And this is saying how the A mode at time tm is correlated with the B mode at time tn, right? There's kind of a lot of like subtle trigonometry that went along here, but this is kind of the end result. And so now we just evaluate these integrals. So for concreteness, I'll approximate the escape velocity to be large, and I'll take the velocity distribution to be Maxwell-Boltzmann. And what you get is this structure where you have some an exponential divided by root, kind of almost rational polynomial times a cosine of a phase term. And the so this is the amplitude and this is the phase. And the cosine switches to sine when you go to the off-diagonal matrices. When you plot these as a function, note they only depend on delta t over tau. So when you plot them, this is what they look like, right? So at time t equals zero, the a's are maximally correlated with themselves, right? Any random variable is maximally correlated with itself. So it peaks, and this correlation falls off with timescale tau, tau c, sorry, the timescale set by the correlation time. because of this phase, it actually like dips below and is anti-correlated with itself for a little bit. And then this asymptotically goes to zero now. And then for the A and B modes, the A's and B's are initially completely uncorrelated with, like A and B at a given, at the same time are uncorrelated with each other. But, you know, if you go a little time later, the A and B are correlated with, are pretty strongly correlated with each other. And that correlation again falls off exponentially. Sorry, not, it's not exponential actually, right? Because if you look at the large X limit, the limit of large X here, it's a polynomial, it's a 1 over x to the 3/2 fall off. Okay, right, but I guess the key point, so keeping track of all this time dependence is really, you know, can be useful depending on the type of experiment. For this talk, just for simplicity, I wanted to show you that we can do this, but I'm gonna always, you know, I'm gonna always talk about the case of observation time much less than coherence time. So that's the limit of small x here, with, in which case the A's and B's are independent of each other. Here's just another way to visualize this, right? So as I mentioned, right, so this is a 2M by 2M matrix where the, you know, it's block diagonal, and each block has this structure where it's either symmetric or anti-symmetric, and then as you move away from the diagonal, the covariance matrix follows these functions, right? Just a cool plot. Okay, so as I mentioned, I'm gonna work in the limit of time is much shorter than the coherence time, but I just wanna kind of say like why, you know, why I even care about this full time dependence information. For one, it keeps track of the phase of the signal, right? So these guys vary only on timescales of, you know, of the coherence time, and so which is 10 to the 6 oscillations of these guys. So you can imagine, you know, integrating your data over in chunks, where each chunk is less than the coherence time, and so then look at the within each chunk, you should see a an essentially coherent oscillation at frequency MA, and you know the amplitude at that of that chunk is A of T or B of T, or well square root A squared plus B squared, right? But this keeps track of the phase. So if you, instead of only talking about the power spectral density, you kept track of like your real and imaginary parts of your Fourier transform, that's your A and that's your B, right? So this can be useful depending on, you know, how the data is analyzed and collected. It's also super, like having the fact that I have an analytic representation or semi-analytic for the covariance matrix makes it like very easy to generate mock data for these guys. And again, the fact that you only have to generate one amplitude every coherence time, as opposed to sampling, you know, generating mock data sampling at 10 to the 6 times, a frequency 10 to the 6 times higher than that. It just saves space and computation time. But of course, if you wanted to just get like the overall two-point correlator, like A of T correlated with A of T prime, which depends, which by symmetry should only depend on tau, I can just write it. It's calculable, give it from this formalism. It's exactly this. And so this has been, you know, this has been computed in the literature, but to my knowledge, these have not been computed in the literature, and I think it's a higher information presentation. But okay, and as I've said before, you know, for simplicity and for like kind of just like talking about qualitative effects, I'm only going to consider the limit of time much shorter than the coherence time. In that case, the A's and B's don't vary in time; it's just the single A and B. And you can easily, and they're independent of each other. So you can easily transform back into these Rayleigh amplitudes and phases. And this is what you get, right? So basically the intuitive picture was basically right. You take the dark matter field you thought it was, stick a random Rayleigh amplitude in front of it, and you know, and that's basically correct. Here, this is just a plot of like one particular random evolution of the A's and B's, and then the corresponding, you know, motion of alpha. So the computing alpha is not Gaussian distributed, so it's harder. You it's not described solely by its two-point correlation function, which is why I haven't bothered to like show you the two-point correlator for this alpha. Right, and then the phase, of course. Okay, but yeah, this is the key thing to remember. So this construction is correct as long as the time, the observation time is much less than the coherence time. So now let's kind of carefully consider what would happen if you have some experiment where you, the signal you're searching for is some coupling times the axion field. Consider just one particular frequency MA, T much less than the coherence time, and random noise, right? And so let's just go ahead and assume no signal found. And so we want to set a limit by constructing the posterior distribution for the coupling. And the way we do this is integrating the likelihood over the random nuisance parameters, right? So in the deterministic approach, what you do is you have a well-specified amplitude and then a random phase, because I'm assuming that the experiment is insensitive to phase. So you would marginalize over the phase, right? Or you could do this in the frequency domain, but just for concreteness, I did it in the, let's just consider the time domain. So that would be the deterministic approach to construct the posterior. For the stochastic approach, it's the same, except you have an extra Rayleigh amplitude. And note, there's like a rescaling by 1/√2, which comes from the fact that the variance of alpha of the Rayleigh distribution is 2. To construct the posterior distribution for G, we just marginalize over the phase and the random amplitude. So we integrate over the alpha and weight by the Rayleigh distribution, and just compute you can compute these integrals for some given randomly generated null data set, which is what I've done here. So here in blue, the blue line is the posterior distribution in the deterministic case where you don't have the random amplitude. You set a code, this dashed blue line corresponds to where you would set your 95% limit on the coupling. This is all arbitrary units because I'm just kind of working in the abstract, but you set your limit here. Now in the stochastic case, as we kind of saw intuitively, the presence of the random amplitude causes a spreading in your posterior distribution. Specifically, it looks like this. And so your 95% containment on the posterior is somewhat further up, right? And it's sort of like an almost order of larger than order one, almost order of magnitude factor. And this has been computed, this has been computed in the literature before, but my formalism reproduces this. Okay. All right, so that's the axion field, the experiment's coupling to the axion field. How am I doing on time, by the way? Sorry, I haven't.
Yeah, you have like perhaps 10 more minutes.
Okay, that should probably be good. So that's the axion field. And so now I'm gonna move on to the next phase, which is the field gradient, because it's similar, but a little bit different. Okay, so let me just take a step back and talk about naively, what do we expect, right? For the gradient, right? We know that this construction works for the axion field. And so naively, you might just say like, okay, ignore velocity dispersion. When I take the gradient, I get a factor of momentum. Oops, actually I have a typo here because there should be a one, there's an MA that cancels out the 1/m here. But you insert a factor of momentum. And roughly speaking, in the deterministic case, this is totally not right. It's just ignoring velocity distribution. You would replace this with the average velocity, which is the net motion of the Earth through relative to the galactic center, which I call VLAB. That's kind of the simplest possible construction. For stochasticity, we know that this is not actually the correct formalism. We actually have there actually should be a random amplitude. But naively, you might say like, okay, I'm still just inserting a factor of momentum. And so I get an extra velocity. And what people have often done in the literature is assume that the direction of this velocity is exactly, this is the same direction as the net, as the average velocity. And so you get this, that the magnitude is sampled from the, the sort of semi-marginalized posterior velocity distribution function. But basically, this is very similar to what we were just seeing, right? It basically looks like the deterministic case, except you have just an extra random amplitude. In this case, the random amplitude is just the Rayleigh times a Maxwell-Boltzmann distributed thing. But this, this is what has been done in the literature to date. And it gives you similar results in that it rescales your null limits by about a factor of 10. Relative to the deterministic case. Okay, so now let's do, let's apply this, kind of like complete formalism in generalize it to the case of the gradient and see what we see. So, the insertion of the factor of MA times V for momentum is perfectly fine if you consider only a single mode, right? And so this is just the axion field of a single mode times MAV. This is the thing we saw in the previous case times MAV, right? And it's still the total number of modes, et cetera. But now we care about vectors. So we have to 3D, we have to discretize a 3D velocity space instead of just a 1D velocity space. But it basically works the same way. This is a sort of historical artifact of the way I started approaching this problem that I chose to work in, like, in spherical coordinates, V cos theta phi, where the basis vectors here, the polar axis of this spherical system is along the direction of the motion of the of V lab. The result is independent of coordinate system, but just for concreteness, that's sort of what I'm choosing to work in, right? So we have three, we discretize into subsets that are specified by three indices. Within each subset, you have approximately the same velocity, and the polar angle and the azimuthal angle are all approximately the same within some range. Well, I guess the one thing to point out is that this coordinate, this set of basis vectors is fixed in the galactic frame, so they move in the lab frame, but that doesn't matter. Okay, anyway, so just as before, let's consider the total contribution to the field gradient from just one subset. So we sum over all the modes in that particular subset. So we treat the VJKL as constant over this summation. And again, we only have the random phase. So we know, as before, we just get, we get the same thing, except now with a Rayleigh distributed amplitude and a single random phase as opposed to a large number of random phases. And then to get the full field, we have to do the 3D sum over all the different, all the different subsets that we've discretized. And there's an additional thing, which is that the gradient, observationally, we don't measure the vector gradient, but we measure the gradient projected on some lab fixed axis. And so, as I mentioned, these vector basis is fixed in the galactic frame, and so they modulate in the Earth frame. You see something like this, right? So this is V, S, and U, my coordinate basis vectors, as a function of time over one day. And so you see each of these is an independent daily modulation. And so it's useful to decompose grad A dotted into the measurement axis into the three vector basis components. There are three components VSU, and then as before, we further subdivide, we further decompose, that was the word I was looking for, into the cosine and sine modes, just like before. So before we had only two modes because we didn't care about, there were no directions, but now there are two modes for each direction and three directions, so there are six modes. And again, to be concrete, each mode is like a sum over these three, the three-dimensional discretized space. And again, I want to keep the full time dependence, So I considered, you know, some finite number m different times. And so I have 6m sums now instead of 2m like last time. But again, we just take their coordinates and we generalize them. You know, we take them to be uniform random variables and we use the central limit theorem just like before. And so basically what you get is the following. This 6m vector of a's and b's is normally distributed. The mean is zero. Again, that just falls from the fact that the cosine averages to zero. And the covariance has this block diagonal structure where the a and b modes of each component only talk to each other. And this has to do with the fact that we chose an orthogonal set of basis vectors. And within each block component, the AA and AB modes are given by a similar sort of integral to what we saw last time, right? It's integrate over velocity space F of V times cosine of 1/2 MV squared times delta T. But now there's an additional, this is the component of V along each direction, right? So if I had chosen to work in Cartesian basis, this would be Vx squared, this would be Vx squared, this would be Vy squared and Vy squared, et cetera. Okay, and so now we just do these integrals, right? So it's a slightly more annoying integral to do, but it's still tractable. And what you get is that, similar to last time, you get these amplitudes, which have this exponential thing and a 1 over 1 plus x squared to some fractional power fall off. The fractional power is larger, so the fall off is steeper now. And you also get these phases, right? So things will change. Things kind of change sign as delta t over the correlation time becomes large. But this is very similar to what we saw before. And so let me just show you the plots of these guys just to see, right? So this is, the solid lines here are the AA and AB modes for the V component. And then the dashed lines are the AA and AB modes for the S and U components, which are the same. So in particular, we see that the V components give the dominant contribution by about a factor of 2. But the orthogonal components are non-negligible. This is again that cool plot of the block. This is just one block diagonal matrix. This is the A. This is the S part of the block diagonal. The qualitative feature that here, as t is much for t much less than tau, you're at zero. All AB modes go to zero, and the AA modes are non-zero as we would expect. So that means that at times, I guess I actually wrote this on the previous slide, apologies. That means that for times much less than the coherence time, each of the six A and each of the three A and three B modes are all independent of each other and normally distributed. I'm going to skip down to this last bullet point. Because these guys are independent and normally distributed, we can just take them to be Rayleigh, we can do the coordinate transformation, get Rayleigh distributed amplitudes and phases. The key thing here is that there are now, if you're summing over components, so you have a different random amplitude for each component. The V mode gives the dominant contribution, but it's, order one. They're all non-negligible. Let me just say, I'm about to take, I'm only gonna, going forward, consider this limit, but this approach is much more general and can be, can be useful for full time dependence even not in this case. For concreteness, we'll work only in this limit where we can express these guys as independent Rayleigh amplitudes with independent random phases. Okay, so now remember that naive construction we were talking, I showed you a while ago, where we write the grad A as, essentially the oscillating thing times a Rayleigh amplitude times V, V lab, or V in the, magnitude V in the direction of V lab. This only has one Rayleigh amplitude. And it also gets the modulation wrong, because in general the modulation can be any superposition of the V dot M, S dot M, U dot M components rather than purely V dot M. But in particular, it gets the amplitude is only drawn from a single Rayleigh distribution, as opposed to being drawn from three independent Rayleigh distributions. And note that these results agree, these approaches agree in the limit of small velocity dispersion, but I guess that's not surprising, but it's also not a good approximation. These are of the same order in the Milky Way for Earth. I will just kind of throw out there, I haven't thought about this super carefully yet, but if you had instead done a naive construction where you let this velocity V be not drawn from the 1D distribution F of V, but from the full 3D distribution, this might give you have three independent components, so you might get a similar sort of stochastic behavior, but I'm not yet convinced that they're equivalent to each other. But it would probably be qualitatively similar. But that, I don't know if I understand this paper well enough to know if they actually use this construction or not. And for the most part, this is the construction that has been used in the literature. And it appears to be different, right? And in particular, some intuition, right? If for a given observation, G times alpha should roughly be constrained to be constant, right? And if we want to set a limit on G, again, G should be distributed like 1 over alpha, but if you have three independent draws from the Rayleigh distribution, the CDF, if you have one independent draw from the distribution, you get this blue CDF, right? And so you would set your 95% confidence limit at the point where the CDF reaches 95%, which is way out here. That's for just the regular Rayleigh distribution or 1 over Rayleigh distribution. But if you have three independent Rayleigh amplitudes, you're sort of talking about the 1 minus the CDF of 1 over alpha cubed. And these are small numbers, so this basically boosts your CDF, and in particular your 95, you see that in this case the 95% limit goes way back over to the left, much more closer to the sort of naive deterministic expectation you would get, which would be this vertical red line. So intuitively, three independent draws from the Rayleigh distribution better than one, you get closer to deterministic behavior. And doing it a little more carefully, this is the same approach we saw before, where we construct the marginalized posterior distribution by integrating over the Nuisance parameters. For the deterministic case, you just have a phase. For the stochastic case, the naive stochastic case, you have an amplitude, you have a phase, an amplitude, and a velocity that you're sampling from. And for the full stochastic approach, you have three independent amplitudes and phases that you're integrating over. And so when you do this, you find that it's consistent with the intuitive case I showed you two slides ago, which is that, so here the blue is deterministic, right? And you set the 95% confidence limit at this vertical dash blue line. The red is stochastic, is the naive stochastic, and you set your 95% limit way up high. But then the black is accounting for the fact that you have actually three independent Rayleigh draws, and you set your limit back down at the same point that you would have if you had just done a deterministic account. So the stochastic effects in the limit of t much less than tau do not lead to a significant loss of sensitivity for the case of the field gradient. And this is contrary to the results of this paper and elsewhere in the literature, where people have claimed, people have essentially used this vertical red line and said that, oh yeah, just like in the scale, just like in the case of the scalar coupling, you have a decrease in sensitivity by almost an order of magnitude. But that's not, but that's contrary to what we find. Okay, so am I okay on, am I about ready to end? I think the timing worked out pretty well. So let me just put up my conclusions. The conclusion is that for ultralight, I always talked about axions to be concrete, but everything applies to any sort of spin zero boson, dark matter. The stochastic effects can be important. And mismodeling them doesn't always lead to an overestimation of sensitivity, but it can also lead to an underestimation of sensitivity. In particular, experiments sensitive to only the scalar coupling AFT, they do lose significant sensitivity in the limit that the experimental observation time is much less than the coherence time. But for experiments sensitive to grad A, this is not really true. And it's basically the same as what you get in the deterministic case. And then I know I didn't do a great job of motivating it for you, but that's a different talk. It's just all the other things you can use this formalism for, of constructing the axion, the AFT and grad AFT as a Gaussian process as a function of time, is very versatile. And you know, I hope a lot of people will find it useful in the future. But that's all I have.
Thanks, Matthew. So I'm trying to find my icon for. Thanks, Matthew.
Yeah, thank you guys again for the invitation. I'm very happy to talk.
So are there any more questions? I guess it was a very clear talk.
Well, that's one way to take it, but on a side note, like if people have like specific questions, feel free to like send me an email or whatever. I'm happy to talk. So
great. Thanks again. So if there are no more questions, we can just stop the recording and then we can just keep chatting with Matt offline. But just for the record, I'm going to stop the recording now.
Thanks for the talk, Matt. Very nice.
Thank you.